Scene 8, Roseanne Bronstein, 6:05 p.m. Booksellers' conventions are like any others, I suppose. Most of the action is in the bars. The booksellers set up formal discussions and panels, of course. There are some aimed at the beginner, the fellow with the store who has just opened a line of books, or the other fellow who just bought into a bookstore. There are panels on the special problems of occult books, a big line, showing you can be literate and stupid, too. And of religious books, and of large paperbacks, and of children's books, and of questions of promotion and production and sales and so on. I didn't attend any of them, so I can't give you the details. Lots of the booksellers don't attend them either, or if they do, they let their minds wander. The formal business isn't the important part of the convention, I suppose, just as so many of my classmates at college used to think the lectures weren't the important part of their education. It's not what you know, it's whom you get drunk with. If I sound bitter, it's because I don't drink. I have no moral objections, you understand, but it is by my keen, incisive brain, or whatever adjectives you prefer, that I make my living, and I have never quite seen that banging it with a hammer called alcohol, or dope, can improve its functioning. So I sat in the bar, feeling out of place, killing time before the party was to start, and lacking any desire to attend even if Prism Press was to pick up the tab. There'd be more drinking there, and no Giles. If Giles were there, what would that be but an invitation to humiliation? There was no way in which I could bring myself to attempt to plead effectively, or to succeed if I made the attempt. I had the impulse to leave and go home, despite my useless promise to Teresa. And if I had, all would have been well. At least the world would have been short one murder and long one life. In fact, I think I would have done so if I had not found myself listening to the talk at the next table. It was not at first for any reason, not even out of idle curiosity. It was just that the sounds were there and my ears were in the neighborhood and that it was too much trouble to tune out. But then the conversation grew to have a grisly fascination for me. From internal evidence, the people at the next table were minor editors, second lieutenants in the world of publishing, and they were talking about their jobs. The situation was not good. Books sold as well as ever, or better, and the number of books published continued to rise. The inflation that had followed the oil embargo of 1973, however, had raised the prices of everything so that expenses outpaced profits. And how does one make up for lagging profits? The easiest way is to cut down on staff, either by outright firing or by not replacing those who, for one reason or another, leave. I was sorry for them, and yet the rottenness of their situation illuminated my own immunity to their lot. Odd. When I began writing and trying to sell, editors were like demigods to me. They walked in power and bestrode the world. Their heads were cloud high, and their voice was thunder loud, and their glance lightning sharp. Actually, I don't know about the last. I couldn't meet the eyes of editors. I was afraid to. They had the power of life and death, and at their lightest breath, success or failure wafted your way. If their lordly whims were offended by anything in the manuscript, a negligent check-off on a form meant that a secretary would return your material with a rejection slip. Could a god do more? But an editor can be fired, I eventually learned, and when he is fired, he is no longer an editor, merely an item in the statistics of the unemployed. Not so a writer. He cannot be fired. He might be rejected, he might fail, he might starve, he might be forced to keep body and soul together by taking some menial, that is, non-writing employment. He might be ignored by the critics and denounced by the public, but he was a writer, a failed writer, an unsuccessful writer, a starving writer, a writer. No editor could change that fact. Listening and musing pinned me to the spot long enough to keep me from being aware of the presence of Roseanne Bronstein until it was entirely too late. In fact, it was not until she had taken the place vacated by Teresa Valliere and had said, "Hi there, little fella," that I knew what had come to pass. A friend of mine, who had been brought up totally immersed in the Yiddish language and who was fond of lacing his speech with Yiddish idioms literally translated into English, would often say, "It became dark before my eyes," when he wanted to express a dramatic extremity of anguish. The only times when it seemed to me that this might be more than a mere metaphoric turn of phrase was whenever Roseanne saw me before I saw her. She would, on these occasions, invariably greet me in those precise words, "Hi there, little fella." How do I describe Roseanne? She is not exactly ugly or grotesque, but I think they invented the word unattractive for her. She does not attract. I have never met anyone who was willing to talk about Roseanne who did not acknowledge a desire to retreat when she approached. She was short and round, had a wide face and a loud, cheerful voice. Her skin was rough, and when her arms were bare, they gave the impression of being slightly but permanently goose-fleshed. Her face was always innocent of makeup, and there was a perpetual smell of old clothes about her. There was something utterly sexless about her appearance, as though she dated back from a time before the two sexes were invented and differentiated. And yet, hidden beneath all this was a woman. Her breasts were prominent enough, though probably flabby, I wouldn't know, and if half the stories were correct, she was fascinated by men. "What can I do for you, Roseanne?" I asked tonelessly. "I met Teresa Valier in the lobby, and she said you were in here. I must remember to do Teresa a favor sometime in return. Trip her at the top of the down escalator, maybe." Roseanne laughed heartily enough to attract attention from nearby tables. I have never known her to register anything but amusement at remarks concerning herself. It's the reason why, however repelled I am by her, I never find myself actually disliking her. Laugh at yourself, and the world laughs with you. Roseanne said with a fine and futile attitude of carelessness, "Teresa said you're going to the party." I looked at my watch. "I have 25 minutes to make a decision." "She said you'll be talking to Giles DeVore." "If I see him," I said, pronouncing my words precisely, "I don't intend to look for him." "I hope you see him. I know you've got influence with him." "My God," I thought pettishly, "an instant replay. I have become a pipeline to Giles, with everyone in the world at one end of the pipe, but no Giles at the other." "I don't," I said. "None at all." "Oh, come on." She grinned broadly, revealing large teeth with one of the upper incisors clearly capped, hitched her chair closer to the table, and leaned over to knead my arm. I suspect that she was merely performing what she considered an erotic rite designed to rouse my libido and urge me into greater cooperation. Or perhaps she just enjoyed the feel of a masculine arm. Whatever her intent, my skin crawled at her touch, and I was embarrassed by that. I've lost count of the number of girls against parts of whose bodies I've allowed my hand to rest, and always with a cool, slow stroking motion that I liked, and that I always assumed they liked too, even when nothing further came of it or was intended to come of it. It is only when I react to Roseanne that I wonder how many girls have skins that crawl at my touch, and I am embarrassed retroactively for having annoyed every one of them. "Talk him into coming to my place for an autograph session for his new book," she said, with a voice that gave me the impression of a crow trying to coo. "Why me?" I said. "Ask him yourself." A vague embarrassment passed over her face, and her arm dropped back to her own side of the table. "I can't, little fella." Then she said in her own natural voice, held low and controlled, "You know, I made him, Darius. His book went nowhere in hardcover, and would have gone nowhere in softcover if I hadn't pushed it." "We all made him," I thought sardonically. "I made him, the Valiers and Prison Press made him, Roseanne Bronstein made him. Yet somehow he was standing there on his own now and could spit at us all." Of course, there was something to what Roseanne was saying. There is a large public that reads only fashionable books, and only enough of them to be able to talk about them fashionably. A book needn't be good or readable to be fashionable, though it could be both, of course. And the way you can tell that a book is fashionable is to have it on the bestseller list. That means bestsellers sell by virtue of being bestsellers, and therefore tend to remain on the bestseller list. For that matter, if a bad seller were put on the bestseller list by mistake, it is very likely to become a bestseller in truth, merely because it was tabbed with the name. There are ways of putting books on the bestseller lists by means of a good, hard, sometimes expensive push, and then letting them stay there and earn back the investment. A strategically placed bookstore could do it. It might push a book over the line, and that meant Roseanne Braunstein. She is the owner and major force behind The Oriole, a downtown bookstore. It is a large barn of a place whose stock can't possibly be known in full by any human being, including Roseanne, but she says that given time she could find any book in the world within reason. I wouldn't in the least consider it impossible that, growing interested in crossover, she could push it effectively not only in her store, but in other stores where her opinion in such matters was valued, and that meant places as far away as San Francisco. She was well placed to push the book in the downtown university area, and that was where, as a matter of fact, it had caught on first. There was no question, for instance, of the great success of the autographing party at the Oriole in December 1973, because I was there. Giles was signing paperback after paperback in a never-ending stream while Roseanne hovered over him in proprietorish fashion. That was the first time, I remember, that I had ever seen him sign books with those inscribed throwaway ballpoints. I remember he tried to get me to use similar pens, pointing out their triangular cross-section and how easy that made the grip, but I demurred. I don't sign books that often, though I signed about a dozen the day of that party. Get a reader excited enough, and he will find even a minor league signature acceptable. And any pen will do for me. In fact, it's a good idea not to carry a pen sometimes, since then when the inevitable youngster pushes a torn piece of paper at you, you can smile and say you have no pen, and of course he'll have none either. After that, Giles got to the point where he would use no pen but his own, monogrammed and triangular. How could he tell the fatality of it? With that autographing party in mind, I said to Roseanne, "I know you pushed the book, Roseanne. Too bad you don't push mine the same way. I take it Giles is ungrateful." "We were friends," she said. "I did it for him out of friendship. We were very good friends." She paused a little as though to recall the goodness of it and get it straight in her memory, and I got the very unpleasant feeling that by very good she meant they had been lovers. I had the grotesque vision of Giles selling his body in return for Roseanne selling his book. I hoped earnestly that Roseanne hadn't heard my just-expressed hope that she would push mine the same way. She was kneading my arm again. "You know, times are hard, and the Oriole is a relic. I've got to remodel or move or something. Make it my last time." "Come on," I said. "The Oriole is as permanent as the university is. It's a historic monument." "The pigeons shit on it, if that's what you mean, and the university isn't all that permanent either. It would help if Giles were to hold another autographing party, maybe identify himself with the place in some way. I did it for him when he needed it. He can do it for me now." "Well, ask him." "You ask him. I haven't even managed to talk to him in over a year. In fact, it's 6:30 now. Go, will you? I don't want you to miss him." "I might not see him." "You'll see him," she said in desperate confidence, and heaved herself to her feet, puffing and stirring up the old clothes smell. "I'll do what I can," I said. "Thanks, little fella," she said, and slammed my shoulder in what was meant to be a rough man-to-man gesture of affection, and sent me staggering sideways. My first reaction was one of intense annoyance, but then I caught a glimpse of her face in a moment when her self-protective shield had failed her. Anxious, pitiful, knowing herself unloved and unlovable. I was sorry for her. Whatever there was inside that hulk, the inside Roseanne, it was nothing at all like the body that imprisoned it, and it was helpless ever to express it. I said, "I'll go to the party, Roseanne." And that was the moment of decision. The conversation at the next table had held me for Roseanne, and Roseanne, by allowing me to catch her in all her vulnerability, made it impossible for me to refuse to make at least the effort. So I went up the escalator to the third floor and to the ballroom where the party was to be held, and I had lost the chance of escaping, the chance I had all but taken.